Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus. You have accessed entry 1455.1C1408, certificate number 46465, UMEX.
You know, there are whole genres of music that the future will not know existed because...
Including Seattle indie rock in the 2000s.
No. Like, Omnibus is very good at commemorating that.
Oh, that's true.
Like, you know, if you want 15 minutes on every Built to Spill record, I'm sure it's somewhere in our catalog, but do we have a single show on jazz? Maybe not.
I refer enough to...
You just say jazz cigarettes.
But I'll talk about Count Basie and...
Yeah, you're always talking about
Count Basie. Duke.
You're talking about Count Dooku. And you think you're talking about Count Basie and the Duke.
I was raised on jazz. I was raised on big band jazz, though, because my dad was old enough that he didn't even think cool jazz. He thought that was like modern music. Like,
no,
come on. It's just a bunch of guys all soloing over
each other. Go back to California.
Yeah, if it didn't have five saxophones all playing the same thing.
It's got to have a very sweet clarinet, and your dad is like, here we go. This is what won World War II.
I'm peaking our levels because I'm so excited by jazz. But it wasn't until, you know, my mom listened to soul and my dad listened to jazz. And I didn't hear rock and roll until the end of the 70s when I started to have...
And that's when it really got good. That was the perfect time to get into rock and roll.
That's right. I think it was the You're Alan like, Parsons Project.
Like, what is this? Is this Blondie?
I started going to roller rinks. That's exactly what it was. And all of a sudden it was like Heart of Glass.
That's why you're so into New Wave.
Yeah. Devo.
You're super Devo. Take off that hat. Like, nobody can see this. No. We don't have a video feed.
This is my normal recording
it's
hat.
My, what do they call them? Energy
dome. Energy dome.
So, I was thinking we didn't have a show about country, but that's not quite true because Nudie Suits had quite a bit of country.
Right. And didn't we, we did some like Border Blaster radio show about people down in the South.
Oh, yeah. But it was some character. It was some other guy that turned out to be the guy who invented putting a transmitter in Mexico.
Right.
Listeners will know who I'm talking about, but yeah, I don't.
And I think I made a note that I was going to do a whole episode on, the X, the border. But now X means something else.
It means Twitter.
If Billy Gibbons says he heard it on the X.
It's no longer.
Yeah, it means some dumb tweets.
But I mean, it really is kind of a myopic view of the future we're giving them if we have 20 shows that mention the Spinanes or something.
And then, yeah. Well, in the future.
And then not a single show that has any kind of world music. I think there's one classical music show, maybe. No, we have two. We have Listomania and that Rite of Spring show. If avant-garde 20th century ballet counts as classical.
Yeah, the crustaceans of the future that are sitting listening to the show are going to say, why didn't this show with the Mormon guy and the sober indie rocker talk about jazz music more? But we should. We're informed, well-rounded.
It's not too late for us to pivot to such a degree that people will eventually say, now in the first 5 years of the show, they hardly mention jazz.
Yeah.
But it quickly becomes.
So is your show today on Dave Brubeck? Because I figured that would be your entry point.
That's every smart white kid's introduction to jazz, right?
Like Lawrence Welk.
We all love Thelonious Monk, but is he playing in 9-8? Mm-hmm. Is he playing in 7-4? Probably not.
No, I was in a bookstore yesterday, and there was beautiful Mexican music wafting from somebody's Spotify playlist.
Was it Tex-Mex, or was it, like, how would you describe Mexican music?
It was mariachi music of some kind, because I am ignorant enough that... Is this your idea of Mexican music? Is a thumping bass?
Well, you know, there's the
no, it's got trumpet.
There's the influence of polka on Mexican music that I can't not hear.
Well, this is relevant. Is that just because you think all brass sounds the same?
No, I spent 2 weeks in Oaxaca one time where I got deathly ill. I got some kind of bird flu and was laying on a sick bed in a hotel room right, you know, in the center of Oaxaca. And across the street, there was a guy set up with the world's largest sound system.
And he was playing tuba music?
That he had inherited from, from Alice in Chains. And he was playing a steady, you know, a steady playlist of and it got into my soul.
I think what you need is guitars going jing-jing-jing-jing. That's Mexican music, not oompa, oompa.
There's always oompa. You're going to hear it eventually. But
I think it's your sickness. You were...
Yeah, I was in a fever state.
You were hearing lower frequencies because of your theta waves in your brain.
Rattling my twin-sized bed with my four-inch thick mattress.
Well, we should be clear that there are many different kinds and strains of Mexican music, and it would be a terrible generalization to say that jing-jing-jing-jing... is all there is.
You're already alienating all of our Mexican listeners, but go on.
Well, this is a show about how Mexican music reads outside of Mexico, because I was immediately swept away to an imagined time of sun-baked adobe houses, because I really like the traditional sound of mariachi music, but for totally problematic exoticizing reasons.
Because your favorite movie was Three Amigos?
It's probably worse than that. It's probably some even more racist John Ford movie that this music reminds me of.
Yeah, it's a form of Orientalism.
It is, right? Except it's whatever is south. Oriental would be east. It's what is south? Australism.
Australism, which is in itself a terrible colonial.
Australism sounds like a medical problem. My doctor says I asked my doctor why I have to pee four times a night, and he says it's Australism.
That's where we signed the treaty in Australism.
So, you know, because it's, you know, to me, I don't know enough about the genre or about the musicianship or about the different schools of anything. So I'm just hearing something that's redolent of something else and something imagined.
You don't have a murder ballad time. Like a mixtape?
We should do a Narco Corridos show for sure. How have we not?
That stuff is dark.
Well, that's coming for sure.
We should have done, right? Well, you're just describing all of the music episodes we haven't done.
Guy Who Shot Selena. I guess we're not a true crime podcast. We're not going to do Guy Who Shot Selena.
But. Right, probably not. No, but
that kind of music does not intersect with Anglo music that much.
No, but we do have a lot of exposure to it, because every West Coast town has a large, you know, Hispanic population, and the music is playing.
You can't go to
a
bodega without hearing it. You can't go to a taco truck without hearing it.
Like, I live adjacent to Burien and South Park, which are both like large Hispanic populations.
So you can't drive by your neighbor's house without hearing it.
It's going all the time, but we do hear it in a context, right? It's we don't hear that much Laotian music, because they don't often have sound systems that they inherited from Alice in Chains.
They're also polite in using earbuds.
Or they only, you know, play music in at certain times of year. No, that's not true. My neighbors used to be Vietnamese.
What happened to make them not Vietnamese?
Then the UFOs came down and changed everybody's race.
I am not in favor of genetically modifying the Vietnamese, and I'm on the record.
No, I used to live next door to a Vietnamese family, and, you know, karaoke is a big part of Vietnamese culture.
Hmm.
And they had a home karaoke machine that was obscenely loud, and Vietnamese karaoke, I will tell you now, is incomprehensible to me, at least.
That's a shock.
Because
did you really think you were going to be able to like listen enough to get some sense of it? Oh, I think they're talking about...
No, I mean incomprehensible tonalities.
Oh, artistically.
Like, as a musician, I was sitting in my house with a front row seat to what seemed to me to be microtonalities that were not in sync in terms of what you would describe as musicality.
It's not just the chromatic scale. They also don't have a four count.
I feel like there are like we're nine scales at work. And I remember tweeting about it at the time and getting...
canceled.
This was before canceled. And getting a lot of reply tweets from Vietnamese kids just laughing, like, oh, you have no idea
how weird it is.
And like they were forwarding my tweets along to their friends, like, get a load of this guy, like this is his first experience of what was then eventually a cultural gyre
for you. You got super into atonalities of Vietnamese.
I started only getting food at places that had like open mics.
Well, I think I'm glad that the Vietnamese kids were supportive of your journey, because I'm going to...
At the time, these days, I'm sure there would be mob violence.
There'd be massive marching.
But in 2013, it was still a kinder, gentler America.
Well, maybe Edward Said will roll over in his grave, but I think I'm kind of generally in favor of this kind of a thing, because that kind of exposure can be a first step for somebody. Like the movie Coco is beautiful for people in that community to feel themselves seen for like a Latino audience. But for like a white kid who's like, hey, that's interesting. Like, even if it just at first glance, it's tamales and jing on a guitar, like that, that's opening a door.
Yeah. My daughter really loves Coco and is living in a world where there will never be a time she'll remember prior to having been introduced to the Day of the Dead and the culture around it. Now, it is a Disneyfied version of it. It's like being introduced to Scandinavian culture through Frozen.
That's what I'm saying. It's a very small first step, and it's easy to make fun of that, like the kid who's super into some kind of weird kind of anime. But
music is so specific to certain cultures, it's not surprising that we don't, any more than anybody else would, instantly respond to something so intertwined or tied up with a culture. Like when I mock Oompa music, really I'm mocking the Poles and the...
You don't care about the music.
And the Bulgarians.
I just really hate the Slavs so much. Did you ever walk through any of their lands?
Well, you know, Ken.
This is why going to Oaxaca reminds you of Oompa music, is because you were walking through Central Europe.
Oaxaca is the Bulgaria of Mexico City.
Did I ever tell you about when I Oaxaca'd across? Well, I mean, you don't. So, like, I feel that about all world music, Celtic music makes me feel something, and African music makes, and Middle Eastern music. And it's wrong, because I don't understand any of the subtext, but music seems like a good first bridge, maybe just because lyrical content aside, it is kind of a universal language.
Well, I was thinking about this the other day, because West African pop music, like guitar music, really, really moves me. And it always has.
Is it different than the South African stuff that I would know from Paul Simon? What's West African sound like?
Well, it's got its own sound. It's very much like a, at one level, it's, like guitar rock. But the way the guitar is treated as an instrument, and the kind of vocal melodies and the tonalities, like it moves me the same way that the first time I heard Prison Colon Ensign Kusel, I was like, what is this amazing tune, before I even knew the story.
Yeah.
And like Fela Kuti is the one that most people are first introduced to, but the whole musical like universe that he came from and then that he inspired, it just drives me in a way that, like, I would not even call it world music. I think of it as, and world music is such a weird,
like, I know, right?
Everything that isn't the Scorpions is
Peter Gabriel loves world music. He likes music from planet Earth.
Yeah,
that doesn't sound like Genesis,
but it's so killer. And in particular, the guitar is a thing that, as it goes around the world, you can. I had a guitar when I first went to Morocco. I was carrying a guitar with me, And I got there, and people, you know, kids that I would run into or people on the street would be very interested in hearing me play and sing.
Oh, really?
Like, you know, stop me and say, like, do a song. And at first, you know, I was just like, this here's a story about Billy Joel and Bobby Sue or whatever, some dumb, you know, and they would just be delighted.
Because to them, that's world music.
Totally world music, right? Like bizarre. And so eventually I started handing the guitar over and to them, like, well, now you play me a song. And the first thing they would do is completely retune it.
Yeah.
And it was a new instrument. Like I didn't know that my guitar could make those sounds. And then they would do a song and hand it back to me, and I'd have to, you know, find my own tuning out of it. So it's, you know, the guitar isn't like an incredible friend, because it's all the music is right there. It's like a piano that you can carry.
And probably discovered independently. Every culture realized if you strung a tight string over a hollow thing,
yeah,
bong, it would sound bong, like bong, 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 bong. So this is one of my favorite stories about the cultural reach of music, and it's kind of an obscure and recently unearthed one. But let's go back to the golden age of Mexican film.
Oh, yeah.
From the 1930s to the 1950s, Mexico was the third biggest movie exporter in the world after the U.S. and India. There were years there where the Mexican film industry was making 125 movies a year.
Wow.
And I, you know, analogous to the musical output of pretty much every nation on earth, I have never seen any of these movies.
Is that right? In all of your Scarecrow video years, you never went through a phase?
I've seen the movies that Buñuel made in Mexico when he fled whatever he was fleeing, Franco probably. He made a couple of great, really great Mexican movies. And I think, and you know, and that was...
As a Spaniard.
That was kind of what jump-started the Mexican movement, was not Buñuel, but actually 20 years earlier, Sergei Eisenstein got some money from Upton Sinclair, of all people, American socialist and future gubernatorial candidate Upton Sinclair, uh-huh, to make a movie about the people, the agrarian power of the Mexican collective after, uh-huh, the revolution. And so he went down to Mexico and shot 50 hours of film and never finished his movie Que Viva Mexico because, I don't know, the funding collapsed. Upton Sinclair stopped getting royalties from the jungle or something. And anyway, the movie never came out. But having, like, you know, the biggest avant-garde director in the world kind of helped jumpstart an industry because he needed camera people and he needed sound people. And obviously...
Well, when you think about all of the art of the first half of the 20th century, a lot of it was used as political...
Propaganda.
Yeah, as agitprop, right? Like
the modern language of film editing is largely a bunch of Marxists figuring out how you can make people feel something. And now it all gets used in Marvel movies.
Hear, hear. As God intended.
We finally...
We've taken Marxism and turned it into something we can sell.
Who knew that Tony Stark was so compatible with Marxism? But, you know, you've also got, obviously, the capital of the movie is just right across the border. Right. So there's, at the time, there's lots of flow back and forth. And, in fact, one of the greatest directors of the golden age of Mexican film was a guy named Emilio Fernandez, who won the Palme d'Or in Cannes in 1944 for a movie I've never seen called Maria Candelaria. But he actually came from the LA film industry. He was just kind of an itinerant wandering around the States doing stonemasonry and other artisanal work. And when he landed in LA, what they needed was somebody to do whatever, set design or something.
The stonemasonry of film.
And he wound up, you know, going from real stone to fake stone. And he wound up going from that to being an extra in some Bible epic to being Douglas Fairbanks's screen double.
Huh.
So, you know, maybe a camera double or maybe a stunt double or something. And there's a rumor, although I don't know if this, it seems too unlikely to be true. It seems like the kind of thing that would have started on the other side of the border, that at some point, Cedric Gibbons, the MGM art director, gets him to strip down. This is going to be a good story.
Okay.
When a guy named Cedric asks a strapping Mexican man to take off his overalls.
His chemise.
And pose with a sword, and that is the Oscar statuette.
Wow.
There's a longstanding story that he's, urban legend possibly, that he's the basis for the Oscar statuette.
Was he bald? Isn't Oscar bald?
Emilio Fernandez was not bald, but maybe the artist could imagine what a bald head would look like under his
but then again
under his fine head of
I don't know
Mexican
whether
hair.
Oscar is actually bald. I'm
Oscar is bald, right?
Googling a picture. Is he just, he's just a, he does seem bald. He actually seems like the naked blue man from those Marvel movies.
When Dustin Hoffman won a, when Dustin Hoffman won his Oscar for, I think, Kramer versus Kramer, he looked at the Oscar and said, he has no genitalia and he's carrying a sword. And I think he's bald as well. So that, anyway, so Emilio goes home and, like, you know, becomes...
How do you know he has no genitalia if he's carrying a sword right in front of what would be his or her genitalia?
Or her. Presumably the sword is narrow enough that it's clear.
Well, that's normative.
Dustin Hoffman is assuming that the Oscar statuette representing excellence would also be extremely girthy.
Oh, okay.
or maybe the sword is not as big as he thought. I don't know. Oh, actually, wait. Is he wearing like trunks?
It's a pretty big sword. No, I think like those are his. Those are his well-defined.
That's not a speedo. That's
lower
his,
abs.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, it might be a some kind of metallic.
This is the longest underpants I've ever looked at the Academy Awards.
Me too.
Midsection, and I invite listeners to bring up a photo and play along.
Yeah. You never see him from behind. I can't tell whether he has shapely buttocks or not.
Anyway, Fernandez returns to Mexico in 1933, and it's people like him that really jumpstart industry, but also it's market forces. This is
not market forces.
Let's tell this story in a way that's compatible with Marxism. There is a huge emerging market of dozens of nations that want Spanish language movies, and Hollywood's not helping. You know, if you're in Paraguay or Cuba or Puerto Rico and you want Spanish language movies, Mexico, with its adjacency to the U.S. industry, is a likely place to center that industry. And then World War II cuts down on U.S. products. So even films that would have been exported to the Southern Hemisphere are not making it anymore. You know, to the Latin American world are not making it anymore. And now there's a real industry there. And, you know, it's profitable. There's a big Spanish-speaking population in the U.S., so you start to get U.S. co-productions. You get crossover stars like Dolores del Rio. Pedro Armendariz is one of the biggest names of Mexican film, and John Ford starts putting him in his cavalry movies of the Old West. You might remember him from Russia with Love. He died. He had terminal cancer, and he's Bond's Turkish friend. And
oh yeah,
this guy he's pretending to be Turkish, but he's like the greatest actor of the Mexican screen at the time.
I mean, you've traveled a bit in South and Central America.
Yeah, a couple trips to Mexico and a couple trips to South America.
And I've been to Mexico several times and to South America a couple of times. And I've had quite a few conversations about the difference within Latin America between the perception of Mexican television.
Which is now ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous, right?
Telenovelas.
And everybody's watching Mexican soap operas. But that Argentines and Chileans have their own actor, you know, their own kind of form and their own whole film culture, and they feel like Mexican film and television is like it's overwhelming, and they're just kind of dismissive of it.
It's probably like a British viewer watching
constant
NCIS or something, right. You know, or even The Good One, you know, even watching The Wire, you know, it's a little different than us watching Downton Abbey because Mexico is kind of they're the big megaculture in that arena.
But like, you know, the main character of The Wire is Welsh, pretending to be from Baltimore.
Wouldn't it be funny if he just did a Welsh accent?
Well, wasn't he in Girls? And he did an American accent when he was in Girls too.
I've seen him in a couple of things where he does.
He does his normal
accent.
No thanks.
So, in fact, Emilio Fernandez actually co-writes a version of John Steinbeck's story, The Pearl, with John Steinbeck. Like, John Steinbeck himself is making Mexican movies in the 50s. That's how mainstream a cultural, how big an audience this is. But, of course, it's killed by TV.
Television.
We did it! Television arrives in Mexico and Latin America in the 50s and 60s. And
Ricky Ricardo takes all the focus off of Mexico.
And everyone's like, this guy's barely even Cuban. Come on.
Nosy!
But it's the kind of thing where if you don't need to go out of the house every night to have kind of cheaply made melodramatic entertainment because it's now arriving, and it's arriving in the form of telenovelas. You know, this story is kind of an early version of the telenovela story where, you know, cheaply made melodramatic Mexican culture finds an audience among the working class all over the world. and the kind of movies that Hollywood started making to counter-program TV, you know, big widescreen Technicolor epics, the Mexican industry, Mollywood, I don't know if they ever said that, could not, that seems wrong, could not compete.
With the sweeping 70 millimeter.
With the robe or whatever.
So Mexican, 900,000 extras.
So Mexican film never has a renaissance like American film did after, you know, fighting back against TV and just getting everybody to go to road shows of The Sound of Music or 2001 or whatever. And so Mexican movies went into an artistic and commercial decline. But for 20 years, Mexico was one of the world's great film capitals. And it's had, you know, it's had a bit of, there are great Mexican directors now, obviously winning Oscars, but this was its first boom. Now, half a world away around this time, it's 1948, and that makes me think of one thing. Stalin and Tito are fighting. Don't you hate it? Don't you hate it when Stalin and Tito
fight? There's a lot going on in 1948.
Nope, just Stalin and Tito fighting. That's the main thing.
a lot that's really in the news right now, but let's focus on Stalin and Tito fighting.
I know you're immediately like, I got to talk about Zionism, but hold on. That's not a big part of this story.
But wait, I mean, it does figure into
Let's retain our audience and not talk about what's going on in Palestine in 1948. Let's talk about what's happening in the Balkans, because I know you love talking about walking across the Balkans, too.
Yes, although I never went to...
You never got to any former Yugoslavia?
I have been on tour as a musician, been to former Yugoslavia, but I never walked there because my route took me on the other side.
Northern...
of the Danube.
Oh, interesting. Not even the nice ones, not even Slovenia.
I've been there as a as a musician. Slovenia and Croatia.
Are they huge fans? Were there throngs of?
You know, Ljubljana is a killer town. Really great. Have we talked about Ljubljana?
No, but we almost went last.
Oh, you
summer.
You
yeah.
and Mindy.
Yeah, not you and I.
No.
We should go.
It's so great.
I wanted to add a country I've never been to, and so we were talking about this Austria-Hungary itinerary, and I was like, well, I've been there. Let's get on a train to Ljubljana.
Yeah.
But then I couldn't pronounce it, and that canceled the trip.
There's a lot of L's in it. But yeah, it's just a – it's like a compact little – it feels like exactly what it is, this town that's kind of in the Alps or in the sub-Alps. And what is it? Is it Austrian? Is it Italian? Is it Slovenian? What even is Slovenian? And it's – I don't know. I think it's a perfect vacation spot. Don't overrun it, though.
Well, you shouldn't have announced it.
It's hard to find.
Should we go back and take that out? Should we have Mark Miles?
Most tourists would be like, what? Who? Hey,
Mark Miles, can you edit that so it sounds like we hate Slovenia?
Yeah, or just turn it to Slovakia.
Yeah.
The more people go to Slovakia,
the better. We're going to say the syllable ok in a few different registers, and you can just add that to every time we said Enia.
I feel like people will go to Bratislava and be like, wait a minute, this isn't a cute little mountain town. This is a little rough.
I almost think if we were adding another country to that Central Europe itinerary, we probably would have wound up in Bratislava and added Slovakia instead of Slovenia. But I've heard nice things about both.
I'm saying go to Slovenia over Ok. Slovakia.
Ok. Ok. Ok.
Ok.
Ok.
Doc Ok.
Doc
I mean,
Ok.
No, there are wonderful parts of Slovakia. Don't get me wrong.
Now, you're going to get angry letters from all of Slovakians.
I love lots of places in Slovakia. Just Bratislava is maybe not them.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
The draw.
It's where you start, but it's not where I would start.
Interesting. Yeah. It's where you have to fly into or take the train into more.
Well,
likely.
No, you fly into Vienna probably and take them.
Probably.
Choo-choo.
And then you meet Julie Delpy on the train. Oh. So let's tell everyone what's going on in the Balkans at this time, because it's kind of a funny story. Not funny, haha. I mean, Josip Broz Tito had been the partisan hero who got the Nazis, who had been the figurehead of getting the Nazis out.
Just like Mao.
Just like Mao. Just like Stalin and a lot of those guys.
Right.
But unlike every other guy like that, he thought, I'm not bending the knee to Stalin.
Yeah, he was like a tech bro reinventing the bus.
I'm going to hack... Marxist revolution.
Uh-huh.
And Stalin can have like the stuff up there, but I feel like I could be like a little mini Stalin here in the Balkans.
With the South Slavs.
Like I can have Albania and he won't care.
Yeah.
He's not going to send the tanks down to here just because I'm like, I'm having more geopolitical pressure on Bulgaria than he would prefer.
And nobody's going to care if you take Albania. In fact, they would have preferred it.
So all these little disparate republics have been federated into a big Yugoslavia, barely hanging together through Tito's kind of strongman charisma and political repression. Let's mm-hmm. be honest.
Yep.
Let's,
nobody wants it. What it is. But there it is.
And he is really the only one of these guys. Hungary didn't do it. Romania didn't do it. He's really the only one of these guys that's like, I'm going to set up camp and see if I can be my own guy and not just Stalin's lackey.
Yeah, no lackey here.
And in fact, there's great stories about the rivalry to this day. You know, Stalin would summon him to Moscow and he would say, nope.
Or he'd come wearing a weird hat.
Did you have to do that back then? Like, that was half the fun of being a Soviet puppet, was wearing some kind of weird folk hat.
I told you to come. I didn't say wear a weird hat. Now you make me look like an idiot.
That's why Stalin has to wear an even bigger fur hat. Yeah. To like. So there's a story, and I think the sourcing on this is pretty weak, but I already told the story about Emilio Fernandez's genitals, so I'll tell this one as well, that after Stalin died, some correspondence was found from Tito, including a letter where Tito had said, you've probably heard this story, Dear Stalin, stop sending people to kill me. We have already captured five of them, one with a bomb and the other with a rifle. If you don't stop sending killers, I'll send one to Moscow and I won't have to send a second.
Yeah, I have heard of this.
This guy's threatening to assassinate Stalin, which is not normal. That's kind of a never get involved in a land war in Asia kind of a thing.
Yeah, but he's doing it in a funny way. Yeah, I mean, it's charming.
And he's down there in Belgrade, and maybe he thinks he can skate on that. Like, you know, from Belgrade, you know, if the CIA is threatening Stalin, that's one thing. But if I'm doing it in Belgrade, eh.
I feel like by that point in time, the Balkans had established itself as a place not to light a fuse, not to pour gas on the fire.
And so haven't we seen enough times?
Stalin might have been like, you know, I'm having enough trouble with Hungary at this point. Let's leave Tito to his own devices.
Are you okay with me saying Belgrade? Do you say Belgrade because you've actually been there or something?
You can say it however you like, because the day I start correcting your or anyone's pronunciation is a day that will live in infamy.
Well, you got very angry at me the other day when I said Emilio Estevez. No, Estevez as if it were Gloria Estefan. Because I was wrong. It's Gloria. It's Emilio Estevez.
No, I say Emilio Estevez. Maybe you said Estevez because you were being all like, Mr. I speak Spanish.
I don't remember which way I went. Anyway,
I learned it.
You're limited to the Brat Pack, I guess.
Yeah, I learned it in Brat Pack years. Estevez, I would never.
So John Hughes pronunciations, you're a real stickler for.
Yeah, well, and I feel like I learned most pronunciations of words by reading them in a book, and I don't have dyslexia, but I definitely have. Is there a kind of dyslexia where you just move the vowels around in your mind so that all the vowels like switch places with the other vowels?
But the consonants stay put?
Yeah, I think I.
That's cool.
I think when I read
vocal dyslexia,
when I read a word, I see the consonants, and then in the middle there's some sort of gobble of vowels that could be anything.
That's just brain efficiency, I think. I think your brain has zeroed in on what defines this word. It's going to be the consonants, and then because you've seen that test where they, you know, you can read a paragraph where every word has a letter pair swapped, and the brain can just sail right by.
Right. I think it's because I learned to read Hebrew first, and so the vowels are always up for grabs.
It is in fact Estevez, if in his roots, but. But, you know.
But does he say Estevez?
Are white people saying?
I don't know. Who white knows? People. What does that even mean anymore?
Well, it means his co-stars, Ali Sheedy, Judd Nelson, Anthony Michael Hall, and Molly Ringwald. What are they saying?
Yeah, right.
The brain.
Let's see if there's a video.
Basket case.
If there's a video of Molly Ringwald saying Emilio Estevez, I will be so happy.
Anyway, so. Anyway, I'm going to say Belgrade is what I'm saying.
Okay, Belgrade, you go right ahead.
The other day I said Inspector Lestrade on Jeopardy instead of Lestrade.
And?
Writers were not happy with me. The writers were not happy. But there's some evidence that Conan Doyle preferred Lestrade. And that's how they say it in the Jeremy Brett Sherlock Holmes that I like. And that's not how they say it in the Benedict Cumberbatch.
Benedict
Cumberbatch. Sherlock Holmes that I don't always like.
I don't know why Benedict Bumberdunch is such a thing that everybody says humorously wrong. And I'm not sure if it's become a dad joke and it's no longer funny.
I did not mean to do that.
Oh, you just accidentally did it. Okay, hang on.
Are you watching videos about Emilio Estevez? I'm going to start saying it on the last one.
Yeah.
Center. The only person I don't really see is Emilio Estevez. He really won't
Molly Ringwald's calling out Emilio Estevez as someone who does not hang out with the Breakfast Club kids, doesn't want anything to do with them.
That makes sense. He was the jock.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. He doesn't want to go back to high school.
No. Except most jocks do want to go back to high school.
Why would Emilio Estevez be the holdout? Did he have a bigger career than anybody else after the...
He's got that Mighty Ducks money.
Oh, that's what it is. He thinks he's some kind of big shot.
Mr. Big Shot. So why was I saying about that? Oh, it's irrelevant. We were just talking about how I said Belgrade, and then I started talking about Sherlock Holmes for literally no reason.
Yeah. Welcome to Omnibus, our crustacean friends.
So no segue, but just Stalin and Tito finally have such a falling out that... that Tito begins purging the Yugoslav Communist Party of Stalinists.
What could go wrong?
To this day, yeah. Like, purging Stalinists? Now I've seen everything. That's the opposite of what you're supposed to do.
The Yugoslav army, what a stable institution.
So from 1948 to 55, Yugoslavia enters what's called the Informburo period, which is kind of a troubled time of many purges, except in a weird Twilight Zone reversal. They're getting rid of loyal Stalinists.
Right. Tito's reinventing Stalinism as Titoism.
And this is the move that eventually leads to what in the early 60s becomes the non-aligned movement.
Yeah.
Tito brings Nehru and Nasser and Suharto and all these kind of developing world strongmen to Belgrade.
Yes.
And they sign a treaty saying, look, Cold War is BS. We don't like the U.S. or the Soviets. We don't love everything about either superpower. But together, we could form a third way of populist, largely socialist, largely authoritarian governance of like a big chunk of the world's population if you've got Nehru there.
That's now called BRICS, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa.
Russia had to – it's a bummer for Russia. They had to join posthumously, because they were at one time they were one of the superpowers that this movement was forming against.
Yeah, right.
And now they've been it's like relegation. You're
after Brazil, my friend.
You're now in the B League playing against.
Otherwise, it would be called BIX.
It's true.
Which is kind of rad.
Maybe that's better.
You know, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, all paragons of democracy. It's a
what could go wrong? No problematic homegrown nationalism in any of them. They're great. But anyway, that whole movement kind of started with Tito and his idea that I'm going to stand up to the Soviet. And, Stalin died soon afterwards, so there's a bit of a... And the rapprochement eventually comes in in the late 50s. But for about 7 years, Yugoslavia has a problem. I mean, it's got a bunch of problems because Stalin's got missiles and Tito doesn't. But it's got a cultural problem, too. They have already turned their back on Western culture, on American and Western European culture, in the after the war, for ideological reasons, that's suspect in decadent capitalism. So after the war, if you listen to the radio in Yugoslavia, you were just going to hear Soviet music all the time. And if you went to the theater, and if you went to the theater, you'd be seeing Moscow Nights and other great hits of Marxist-Leninism. And suddenly they can't show that anymore either.
Right.
And they have a problem. But as previously established, Mexico is turning out over 100 movies a year that can be cheaply obtained for Yugoslavian village screens.
And they're part of the, although maybe not part of the non-aligned nations, they certainly would qualify.
They're perfect because you get these movies in, and what Yugoslav audiences see are movies that are, first of all, largely about a peasant population, farmers and laborers like them. Second of all, these are all movies that have been made in the shadow of revolution. So a lot of the movies, the movies cover the 1910 to 1920 Mexican Revolution and the fiery spirit of Zapata and martyrs like that.
Yeah, if there's a bad guy, it's the gringos.
Exactly. And that's the other thing. It's in the shadow of a superpower to the north. So this really resonates with a Yugoslavian audience. in the 1950s to 1960s in a way that you would not expect. If I imagine the Yugoslavians, if I imagine Bosnians and Serbians going to the movies in 1950, I am not imagining them watching tales of the Mexican Revolution.
Well, it's funny because we think of Cuba as being the exporter. Major exporter of yeah. Latin American culture to the Soviet bloc and to the, you know, to the larger world, because they were ideological culture, right?
But this predates that.
Wow, that's awesome.
Batista is still running a capitalist gambler's paradise in Havana at the time when Mexico is sending out the people stories all the way to behind the Iron Curtain. And guess what? Yugoslavia just loves this stuff. There's a kind of a possibly apocryphal story for the third time, that there's one Yugoslavian general in Tito's high command, a Moshe Pijade, and I apologize for all the Serbo-Croatian stuff I'm saying wrong, who had been in Paris before the war and had seen some Mexican cinema. And he was like, you know what's not problematic and we could still get reels of cheap? Mexico. And so he's the one who pulls the trigger on this.
Wow.
And so in huge, vast numbers, this becomes the mainstream culture of Yugoslavia in the 40s and 50s. People turn out in a big way for Mexican movies. Just to take one example, a movie called Un Dia de Vida, I think it's by Emilio Fernandez, that is such an obscure movie that it has never been out on any home video format. I think it's never been out on disc in any country, including Mexico. No cultural memory of it in Mexico. You won't find your abuela, you know, waxing nostalgic about Un Dia de Vida. But they went nuts for it. It played in Yugoslavia for years. And, you know, city folks would joke that, you know, it played in every little movie house in every little town. And everybody would joke that you'd go to a movie theater and it would be like the Wild West, because everybody would come in on horses and wagons from the countryside, because everybody in the fields was abuzz about Un Dia de Vida, one day of life.
And so it has it always been in print in some, like, tattered copy in Yugoslavia, or in, I guess, Serbia now?
Like, I don't know if it's still showing, let's see. I don't know if you could still see it in repertory houses now, but yeah, like, it played for years and years and years.
Is this like Sixto Rodriguez being, like, enormous in South Africa while in America he's working on an assembly line in Detroit and unaware?
Yeah, or David Hasselhoff in Germany. You know, it's one of these stories. Spinal Tap in Japan, except it's a whole culture, because to them, they're getting the same feeling I got in the used bookstore yesterday of, listen to the guitarra,
yeah, yeah,
and look at those tamales, and look at those sombreros. And this particular story, Un Dia de Vida, has a revolutionary story about a Cuban journalist, actually named Martí, although it's a woman, who comes to Mexico to try to interview one of Zapata's guys, a Colonel Reyes, who has refused to recant and is now facing a cruel firing squad under the Federales' oppression. And you know, this really speaks to the revolution. You know, Tito loves this stuff. You know, the government can't put a kibosh on this. This is great politically. And crucially, there's a scene in which Belén Martí, this Cuban reporter, the Cuban journalist, goes to see Reyes' poor mother in her pueblo, where she is weeping for her son on death row. And a song, I think, is sung to her by a mariachi band called Mama Juanita, you know, a real kind of bittersweet, you know, you can hear the tight harmonies and the guitars and the castanets as we pay tribute to this mother's unfailing love for her doomed son. And boy, the Yugoslavians just go nuts for like, they'll call the movie Mama Juanita. Like, how many times have you seen Mama Juanita? Like, the song is such a hit that that's what they think the movie is called.
Now, this is going to be trippy, but, you know, when I say that Mexican music has polka in it, it really does, and it's because the emperor of Mexico,
Maximilian,
was Maximilian,
yes,
and he brought polka music with him,
yes,
and so the Mexican culture.
And they shot him for it. That's how much they hated polka. He faced the firing squad and they were like, you know what? The polkas and the mazurkas, not coincidental.
We're keeping that. We're keeping the polka music year out. But then exporting it back to Yugoslavia, they must have, and plus, you know, kind of gun culture and, like you were saying, you know, kind of like
agrarian peasant spirit. And
but I think well, and are these silent movies? They're not.
No, these are sound movies.
And so I imagine like this is like this weird gyre of cultural appropriation and reappropriation back and forth. There must have been more. They must have identified with it in a lot of ways.
It's probably kind of analogous to Americans hearing Gangnam Style for the first time, in which you know, U.S. dance and hip hop beats have gone over to Korea, become like fortified and concentrated into something even more amazing, and then sent back to us. And we just hear one song, and all we can talk about that month,
right,
is Gangnam Style. Except this was happening in Yugoslavia with ranchera canciones, you know, from played by mariachi bands.
The world is a wonderful place, and this is an example of what's wonderful.
So the movies, the Mexican movies stick around in Yugoslavia for the length of Tito's falling out with Stalin. But the explosion is really a musical one, because bands begin to form in every little city and every little town and every little dive bar in Yugoslavia. Serbians and Croatians and Kosovars are all trying to play mariachi music.
Whoa!
They're all trying to play ranchero songs. Let me see. And they, in many cases, and sometimes they sing in Spanish, but usually they sing in Mexican. So you've got bands like Vocal Trio Jovanovich, but they're posing with sombreros and charro suits on the album cover because... Every local tailor has been pressed into service, like based on repeated viewings of Un Día de Vida or stills, you know, whatever photo reference they have. It's like, make me one of these. I want the faux leather vest. It needs to have the braid.
Can I get a cheaper nudie suit in Belgrade?
Maybe, yeah, made in Zagreb or something.
Wow.
It's in every republic. And I guess according to this documentary I was watching, the music gets more authentic as you get more Mexican authentic as you get further east. You know, as you get more into the country, as you get into Serbia and Kosovo and Macedonia.
Mountainsy.
Like, yeah, these guys want to play real Mexican music. The more west it is, as you're talking about, the more it kind of merges with Balkan music.
Yeah.
And these guys tend to play in Balkan folk costumes, but with a Mexican influence. And it all becomes this fusion-y melange called UMEX, Yugoslavian Mexican music. And I think that's not a term from the time.
Oh.
I think this modern Slovenian author named Miha Mazzini started to find these, you know, Montenegrin men wearing sombrero albums in thrift stores.
Yes.
And he started to think, what is this? And he started to ask old people, hey, why are there all these records? And they remembered.
Right.
They were like, oh, man. Like, you couldn't go, like, I had a band, and you could drive we would drive 2 hours to a gig, and the only thing we would hear on the radio as we switched stations would be our band.
Like, thrift stores are a great boon to the world.
Think how this would have been lost. Yeah. And this author, Mazzini, he wrote a novel, which has since been translated in English, called Paloma Negro, set amongst this boom of Balkan Mexican music. And he made a short documentary where he tracked down a lot of these surviving musicians and had them talk about their stories. You know, this is just for him going to flea markets. And the songs have lyrics like, let's see, what's a good example of this? Kadye volim neka patim. So there's a guy with a sombrero looking off into the distance. He's got a mustache and a trumpet in the foreground. But it says he's from the ensemble Paloma, and he's singing, "Let me suffer if I love her." Kadye volam nekapatim, and the lyrics go, "May I hug you? Sorry, so young and already married. What can I do but return to my woman? Let me suffer if I love her." So, you know, really deep.
No, I feel that.
Yeah, we've all been there.
Can I hug Paloma? You? You're married. I'm married. All I want is a hug.
But you can imagine these...
Back to my wife.
You can imagine these sad songs in that the sonido and the register of Mexican music, but then in Serbo-Croatian.
Right.
It's a beautiful thing.
Have you ever seen Culture Shock?
No.
There's a Seattle band called Culture Shock, which, like, the most of the members of it, well, originally were from Bulgaria, Bosnia, Herzegovina, and they play a punk rock, but it's an amalgam of what we would have called like Balkan gypsy punk.
My friend plays in a Seattle Balkan orchestra, and I always wonder if I can still call it gypsy music, because probably can't.
I think it's like Oriental Carpet. I think you can say gypsy music, but you can't describe people that way. But I do think like they're, having seen them a bunch, there is a weird kind of, you know, some Mexican sound makes it in there that I always assumed was Balkan music that had influenced Mexican music. It didn't occur to me that then Mexican music would have right. reciprocated, and that's what I'm hearing. And I wonder if they know.
Who, the Balkan?
I mean, Culture Shock, those guys are real smart.
Oh,
so,
the Culture Shock.
So they might have been listening to their grandmother's like mariachi records.
The longer the music persists in the Balkans, in the former Yugoslavia, it does start to adopt local folk influences.
The balalaika comes back in.
So yeah, exactly. Like you'll watch, there'll be more violin, you know, which kind of sounds like a, you know, some kind of a Roma carnival musician or something.
Yeah.
And you don't really associate that with a mariachi combo, right? Like you wouldn't be surprised to hear violin, but. But once this Dalmatian folk music from the coast starts making its way into Umex, you know, there's a little more you, a little less Mex, and it starts to develop its own sound. Tito just loves it. You know, it was like his favorite genre. So there's no government interference. One of the musicians says that the only time the government ever interferes is they took a picture in what they thought was kind of an old-timey looking Spanish churchyard to make it, to have kind of an old Mexico flavor, you know, an adobe building, and the Yugoslavian government said you can't show those graves because they have crosses.
Oh,
so the, you know,
yeah.
So to make the ranchero music more atheistic, but that was really the only note the government had. It was always kind of a fringe thing where apparently, like the official government radio wouldn't play a ton of it, but the request shows would be 100%.
Oh,
so there'd be more ideological purity in the countdown or whatever, where it would be all Balkan music, but then the request shows would just be 100% mariachi music, and bands were selling 100,000, 300,000, 400,000 copies of their records. And apparently the thing the bands would always do is they would append, and in a country with 50,000 record players. So you would always say, we sold 400,000 copies, but then you would always say, and Yugoslavia only has 50,000 turntables. And it was true. People were buying records even though they didn't own a record player, because they would
put them up on the wall.
Go to a friend's house or, you know, have it for a party or have it for their next trip home where their parents have one. Or none of these bands ever visited Mexico, but they did start to tour.
In Europe.
Eastern Europe. Yeah, this kind of became... You know, in other countries where Western culture and Western music was sought after but hard to come by, this was the thin tip of the spear that the Polish government would let in.
Right.
So if you were a rockabilly group, you probably couldn't tour Poland, but a mariachi group would make it, and young people would go because this was all they had. So a lot of these guys would go to Poland and get paid in zlotys that they couldn't spend. But eventually, one of them says, yeah, I saved up and I bought a Peugeot 404.
Huh.
And that was the dream in Tito's Yugoslavia. Like, I could actually afford a Peugeot. So these guys did okay.
That's kind of phenomenal. And I wonder if you are trying to hear the Beatles and you get like a Zapatista band from Yugoslavia, whether it scratches the itch.
Do you think they just tore down a lot of music festivals and community, you know, communist built community orchestra centers? And
well, you have to assume that there are shards of it still in the music of Eastern Europe.
That is what happened. Like as you mentioned, the Beatles. You know, the Beatlemania and the advent of like rock as a worldwide force and no longer just a suspect American phenomenon.
Right.
That really kind of was part of the death knell for Umex, because even behind the Iron Curtain,
you had radio for Europe.
Yeah, these guys could not stop the kids from listening to the Beatles. And so what happened was rock beats and tropes started to blend into Umex music, and it became kind of a fusion. And
are you saying taboo rhythms by any chance?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Like these rhythms got a little more, a little less mariachi and a little more taboo. And to this day, what, you know, I guess well into the end of the past communism, what passed for mainstream pop in the former Yugoslavia was this Umex music, kind of a mix of Dalmatian folk with mariachi, and then with a layer of Beatlemania added in to make it pop music, and that got exported throughout the Soviet bloc.
I wonder if you go back and look at the like the Europop.
Oh, like the Eurovision contest?
Yeah,
that
Eurovision
time?
Contests over the years, whether the Yugoslav entry.
There's a lot of trumpet. Why is there so much trumpet from the Balkans?
I wonder. I'm sure you do. I'm sure you see it up until now.
This is, the kind of the first boot. It's like an early echo of what we saw again in the 90s and 2000s, where, as we've mentioned, Mexican soap operas
kind
of took over the world. And then, you know, countries from Argentina to Indonesia to Korea realized, well, we should be making our own kind of inexpensive melodramatic dramas that the masses can enjoy worldwide. And then, you know, it all becomes one big soup of melodrama and mariachi, just like God intended.
Yeah, Korean electropop is like a billion-dollar industry or multi-billion-dollar industry.
Yeah.
And it's a similar kind of thing. I met some guy at a benefit the other day who, like a older guy, who said he was flying to Japan to see this band that he's really into, which is a heavy metal band of made up of Japanese girls dressed like maids. And I was like, oh. He's like, no, they're amazing. I think they're called Maiden Japan, maybe. Or
I'm not a weirdo.
And he's like, no, not a weirdo. I'm gonna send you some stuff. And I was like, no, that's okay. And he was like, no, really. And so he has been sending me links to this Japanese metal band. And I'm like, I don't want to see Japanese girls dressed as me. I mean, I do, but I'm trying to wean myself.
I have my own sights for that.
Yeah, this is not, you're not helping me, 65-year-old friend who is like weirdly into this. So maybe it's coming back. Maybe now metal music is coming back through young Japanese women dressed as maids. And now we're going to, in America, experience a metal revival, but in Japanese.
Well, we finally did a show about Latino music, but it ended up just being about how mariachi is compatible with Marxism. So maybe we didn't do a good job.
Viva. And that concludes UMEX, entry 1455.1C1408, certificate number 46465 in the omnibus. Futurelings, social media died an inglorious death long ago, and we're living through that period of upheaval. All around us, we see ash heaps where social media once was a flourishing garden, but we're still in the throes of that decline, and it's not clear to us what the future holds.
It's time to start importing social media sites from Mexico.
I have noticed now that Twitter is officially garbage and verboten, completely gone, that when I go to the other social media sites that have tried to fill in the gap, and they all are sort of advertising themselves, or people are excited about them being nicer places. They're not. They're just as bad. and so I feel like the whole experiment, am I right in this, or are you still, you're still over there flourishing, people just shower you with affection? I feel it's just like cranks full of rage.
Yes.
And when I say cranks full of rage, it used to mean a very small subset of the population who were cranks, and an even smaller set of cranks that were full of rage. But now, being a crank full of rage is like the most mainstream thing you can be.
You and I were talking about how we used to call them crackpots. Like, if somebody saw Johnny Carson say something and they didn't like it, and they immediately went to their typewriter and tried to figure out how to get their feedback to Johnny Carson, we would be like, yes, sir, you are a crackpot.
Yes, you are a tinfoil hat.
Now that's literally everyone in America. I saw something I didn't like on the TV, and now I'm going to go yell at the speaker on social media.
Nation of crackpots. I cannot find a post by anybody that doesn't, within the first five comments under it, have somebody arguing with them. Like, you could put the most anodyne statement out there, you know, like, I love flowers. And somebody would be like, nice for you. nice for you to love flowers.
What about the rest of us whose flowers die?
Yeah, you know, there are kids dying of starvation.
I live in an apartment. I don't get enough sun for flowers. Must be nice.
There it is. Must be nice to have enough money to ever see a flower. And I'm just like, there's no good. There's no good.
We all used to just only follow comedians on social media, which meant you got to see my favorite thing, a joke, and then dozens of rebuttals to the joke.
Yeah.
Because that's what comedy needs is like factual rebuttals to the premise of a joke.
Well, and also people re-explaining the joke to the person that made the joke. That was especially popular with female comedians. But one thing people forget is that comedians are the most broken people. That's why they're funny.
They will fight with you.
They're not role models. These are not people we ever should have put up on a pedestal. They're every one of them is a monster.
Well, they're also the wrong people to tweak on an anonymous internet forum.
Right.
Because they'll break a bottle and come after you.
That's right.
Even the nice ones.
So anyway, futurelings, thank God you are spared this awful, awful time. We're living in a kind of post-Stalin but pre-Umex world where we're just listening to the worst of both things. But if you do want to see Ken being feted by all of his legion of fans, or me being provoked to...
No, it's just going to be me people complaining about how I pronounce something on Jeopardy.
Yeah, you can go find him anyway at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, at Omnibus Project. Probably the best use of social media is Omnibus Out of Context, which is some weirdo out there listening to our show and taking like two-sentence snippets and then publishing them. They're all non sequiturs.
I think it's on Blue Sky now, too.
Yeah, they're great. And that's basically, you can get as good a look at our show as listening to every episode.
Donate to the Patreon, stop listening to the show, and just read Omnibus Out of Context.
Yeah, but if Omnibus Out of Context has a Patreon, don't give them any money. Send that money to us too.
Parasite.
You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. Unless you are the weirdo who's doing Omnibus Out of Context. And in that case, just stay anonymous. Be quiet over there, weirdo. You can hang out with other futurelings on Facebook, Instagram, in the comments under Omnibus Out of Context, on Discord. Where are some other places that you can hang out with other futurelings? In person in a cafe, if you're willing to take the risk.
Why not? Put Pries and Cole and Ensign Cusel on the jukebox and futurelings will just appear like flies, like moths to flame.
You can send us mail to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. It looks like you got some mail over there.
Yeah, a couple people. Got postcards from people whose vacations were shaped by our show.
Nice.
Kelvin from Canada is in Japan and sent you, and John in particular, a picture of a narrow gauge train.
Oh, look at that.
In honor of your change of gauge entry.
That's pretty cute.
He says, John, you should come to Japan. The current tourism boom means you are not... too much taller than the average person there
Good.
At the moment.
I like to also be lumped in with all the other
gaijin.
Like, yeah, gaijin all from the other, Denmark.
All the other meaty, lurpy visitors following their heavy metal band in maids' outfits.
Yeah.
And let's see, who is this? This is Andrew on a trip through Butte, Montana. Got a Berkeley Pit.
Oh, good.
Postcard. Persuaded my wife to stop to see it.
And?
Even my wife thought it was cool.
Yay!
Good job, Andrew's
I wonder if
wife.
There were giant rafts of dead Canada geese while they were there.
Is that what you want to see in
Have we ever heard from somebody who went and found all of those arrows, those old airmail arrows?
There's a few left. I mean, I believe somebody has sent us photos of them, maybe a postcard. I don't know if anybody ever saw one.
Yeah.
I bet they're hard to hike to because the surviving ones are probably in inaccessible parts of the Rockies, right?
Yeah, but there is that whole American culture of people that are like, hard to hike to? Sign me up.
I moved to Colorado so I can go to the 14 worst places to hike to in Colorado. Oh, no, there's not 14 of them. They're called the 14ers.
There are 14 big mountains in Colorado.
No, they're all above 14,000 feet. There's probably more than 14. Sharon, this is going to be a tricky mail scenario. Sharon sent your daughter a gift, which we should not open on air.
How do you feel about that? I guess that's fine. It doesn't sound like
it's
a bomb.
It's not anthrax. Well, I actually, is this bad? I actually was curious.
Oh, wow.
So I popped the side and I retaped it. You're not going to like this.
Uh-oh.
It's a 2024 one pun a day desk calendar.
Oh, no. Her one pun a day calendar from 2023 has...
It's about to expire.
It's really filled up our house with puns.
Yeah, it's only got... you thought you had a month and a half left as we record this. But nope, as you listen in January, new puns are emerging.
All right, well, I'm gonna save Sharon and put that under the Christmas tree. And so we'll have a big surprise.
A series of small surprises.
On Christmas morning.
All year round.
I've told you, or I've probably told our listeners, that the puns that she likes, she takes and tapes on her wall. So the wall of her room is covered with 2023's worst puns.
But those are so last year.
Yeah, that's
right. We need a new pun calendar for the 2024.
Yeah, they're not drip anymore.
They're not.
They're last year's drip.
I don't think that's how you use drip.
I know. I'm misusing teenage slang all the time. So much so now I don't even know what the proper way to... I mean, I never did know the proper way. The last thing I want to remind you, listeners, is that we are a listener-supported show. And you support us by going to patreon.com/omnibusproject and signing up. There are multiple tiers you can sign up for, but every tier has access to our monthly addenda show. We're actually recording an addenda show after we're done with this episode.
That's true. It'll probably have weird, confusing references to Balkan mariachi music that will not make sense when people listen to it in late November.
Ken is always very disappointed to me, or disappointed in me when I refer to shows that haven't aired yet.
I'm going
to
start wiping your brain like the Men in Black guy. So you only remember shows that we will air before late November.
But you go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. You can subscribe at the $5 a month level, which is less than you spend on Splenda, right? $5 a month. What else can you get for $5 a month? Nothing.
Not much.
But if you bought gum every day, it would cost more than $5.
Who buys gum every day? You're chewing a pack of gum a day?
I love gum. I don't chew a pack of gum a day, but I do go through gum because I use two slices at a time.
I like how you're making fun of crackpots, but you buy a pack of gum a day.
Dear editor. Not a pack of gum a day, but I'm saying if you chew gum every day.
If you put a quarter in a gumball machine every day.
Yeah, that's 30 sticks of gum. That's going to be more than $5 a month. And
easily.
So,
thanks, Biden.
Yes, that's right. Thanks, Obama, who started the gum inflation. But there's really nothing in the world that you can get for $5 a month that it comes anywhere close to four additional episodes of Omnibus and lots of other perks and treats.
Well, they're not getting four additional episodes a month.
How many? Oh, they're getting one additional episode a month.
But a backlog of 50 additional episodes.
Okay, so that's
right. If you parcel them out for a month for a year.
Sure, that's an entire year, right? Yeah. Of eps that you could listen to.
You could replace the long lost and fondly remembered Tuesday show with a year's worth of addenda if you were to give today.
Also, Ken posts pictures of our show notes, of our mail, of candid behind the scenes pics.
Am I going to post a picture of this pun calendar? I guess wrapped.
It's not going to make any sense to anybody until January.
That's true. And by then, the secret's out.
Yeah, right.
Thanks to all those who support Omnibus. We could not do it without you.
I mean, we could.
But we would not.
No.
I think more public radio stations should say that. We could run this at a loss, but we wouldn't. We would stop. We would not do this without you.
I have noticed that more and, you know, almost all media now has been gobbled up by larger media clearinghouses, and then those have been gobbled up. And eventually those get gobbled up by venture capitalists who are not interested in media or anything.
And just want to dismantle it.
Yeah, they are the death of civilization. And so all media is going into the crapper because it's being run by tech bros who are reinventing the bus. And Omnibus remains independent.
Untouched.
We're not beholden to anyone.
Listeners, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. The worst comes soon. This recording, like all our recordings, may be our final word, but if providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.